Hi everyone, this is Mark Eglinton, the co-writer of Rex Brown's Official Truth 101 Proof, and you are listening to Drag the Water. Drag the Water some more.
It is now time to drag the water some more. This is the Pantera Podcast. I am your host, Joshua Toomey, and my guest this week is Mark Eglinton, the co-author of Official Truth 101 Proof, the inside story of Pantera. Mark is a great guest, almost an hour-long interview, and it was so great to talk to him. And speaking of great, the response from episode one with Terry Glaze was so awesome to see all of the great kind words. The download numbers were off the charts, and it just goes to show how much everyone loves Pantera, and just a huge thank you for everyone supporting the show any way you can. Make sure to go leave a nice iTunes review, leave a nice Facebook review, check out the Facebook page. Really cool stuff going on over there. Just a couple of iTunes reviews, and I will read these as they come along. Scott Stein says, Toomey rules, get your pool, go Ravens, hashtag drink more black tooths. That was a great review, had it not been for the go Ravens part, but we'll see about that later on. And I've got a few more that I will read on upcoming episodes, but make sure you're rating, reviewing the show. Every podcast asks you to do it. But we all ask you to do it because it helps the show grow and lets everybody know how awesome the Drag the Waters podcast is. Now, everybody knows that the Official Truth 101 Proof book is very, very polarizing. And when you bring it up in the Pantera world, a lot of people kind of get upset about it. Vinnie Paul was very upset with the book before his passing and things like that. So if you read the book, it's a crazy read. Definitely insightful kind of into Rex's brain. But this was a really awesome interview with Mark Eglinton that I will get to momentarily. But as we did last episode, and we will do every episode of Drag the Waters, we go into the Talk to Me archives where I've spoken to so many people about Pantera, and they've given me great Pantera stories. So this week we go into an interview I did with Ricky Rackman about his time around Pantera.
When I was in this punk rock band called Battery Club.
Yeah.
And Diamond Vinny came to go see us when we played in Texas. And they went there, they bought our cassette, they bought our t-shirt. I mean, they were just party guys. And they what happened is this is a story I should really tell on the podcast. What happened is the band decided to invite all of my band with them to the studio to go hang out. And so all my guys went and hung out with Pantera, and my guys could not keep up with them drinking. So everybody in my band was so trashed. And the next thing you know, my band is having fist fights with each other. One guy is saying to let the bus go ahead of them and just leave them there. And people are crying. I mean, it was just like, it was just because it was just these bunch of Orange County punk rock guys partying with these professionals from Dallas. And it was just so much fun because they really were the guys, like, if they weren't in Pantera, they would have been in the van with you going to see the shows, you know, partying and drinking in the parking lot. I mean, that was what was so great about Pantera. And that I can say, I would say that more than about them than any other band. They were really like for the people.
And guys, go check out that interview with Ricky Rackman. Let me know what you think of that one. And without any more of my ramblings, let's drag the waters with Mark Eglinton. Drag the water some more. All right, guys, it is time to drag the water some more with Mark Eglinton, the co-writer of Official Truth 101 Proof, the inside story of Pantera. Mark, how are you today?
Doing well, thanks. Doing well. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
When you talk about this book and, you know, you bring it up with fellow Pantera fans, it's a very divisive book, man.
Yeah. I think I expected that at the time. You know, when you're only dealing with one person in the band's perspective, in any normal band, you're going to get that. But then when you factor in the sort of Pantera factor, which was already a very pretty divisive story at the best of times, I think it was always going to be a book that divided opinion. The other side to that was that you also think that for that reason it's going to be a book that sells, and thankfully it has done. That's the positive. People wanted to know what was going on inside that band, and given that Rex was the only person that's written about it, it was a logical thing that it was going to do pretty well, and I'm very grateful that it did.
And before we dive into all that, I did want to get a little bit into your background and in writing. And, you know, when did this, the writing bug kind of take over for you? And, you know, where you went down this career path?
Well, a bit of a long story. And it wasn't my original career path. I did other things first. I was in business for a long time, with in the back of my mind always that I was told as a youngster that I was a pretty good writer. Should maybe do it for a career, I think some people said. But when you're 17, you don't think of that, because there's many sexier things than writing when you're a 17 or 18 year old. So I just put it to one side, and it was much later in life when I kind of got to a crossroads with my work, with family. I thought, well, you know, I've got an opportunity now to try this, and that's the way I went. And obviously you've got to find a way to make it happen. And I didn't go down the route of, as many people do in this, of writing reviews for magazines and that kind of thing. That I never did that. And I would have liked to. I just didn't get any opportunities. But I did get approached by a publisher who wanted a biography of James Hetfield of Metallica written. And this was passed to me by a good friend of mine called Joel McIver, who's written books about metal bands, and they're out there. And it was one of these things. Somebody came to me and said, can you do this? And I was a huge Metallica fan. I've been a metalhead since I was 12. And I had no idea how to write a book at that time. But, of course, I agreed and said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, how am I going to do this? And I did. And from there, that was the kind of the beginning. And just to follow on to how the Pantera connection took place, I actually interviewed Rex for that book. At that time, I think Down had toured with Metallica, and I think Rex and James shared sort of certain things they were going through at that time. And he was actually a good person to speak to about James. And I got on really well with Rex on the phone for those interviews. And it was after that I said to him, how about doing something yourself?
Well, getting into, you know, writing a book about James Hetfield, what had you written to show people that you could write? That would
nothing.
Make wow, okay. So
nothing.
So what was the friendship between you and Joel that where he knew that you could do it?
Yeah, I kind of badgered him because at that time I was entertaining ideas about writing various things. And I as people often do, you badger someone that you know is good at it. And I used to email him and say, hey man, I think I could do this. And he'd say, yeah, well, you know, I've been doing this for years, you don't know shit. And in the politest possible way, go away. But I kept kind of needling him, and I think he could tell I knew my stuff, because I knew as much about metal as anyone did. But obviously the part about, you know, can I structure a book, can I research a book, can I deliver a book on time to a publisher, he had no idea, and he took a big chance when he recommended me. And I'll always be grateful for him, and I've always thanked him in all the books that I've written since. And I still talk to him all the time, and he's a very good friend, but I think he's almost forgotten that he recommended me for that book. It's a long ago, but he did. And it was one of these things, all right, well, I've agreed to it. I better figure out a way how to write a book. And I did. And from there, you know, life got a lot easier.
I think those are the best ways to get to do something. You know, if you sat down on your own to write a James Hetfield book, you probably wouldn't have done it, but you had a deadline, you agreed to do it. Now you got to figure out how to do it. And those are some of the best ways to do it.
Yeah, I guess it's just like being dropped in water when you're a baby. You better learn to swim. And that's basically how I felt, because I had literally no idea. So I just pieced it together. I thought, who do I want to speak to? Who could I speak to? Again, all these people were really amenable to talking to me. Tons of people that I couldn't believe would talk to me. But they did. And from there, you get a bit more confidence, start seeing it taking shape, and you get it to the deadline, you deliver it, and it comes out. And you think, okay, I can do this. And from that point on, I've never doubted that I could do it.
Now, were these the Hetfield book, was it through Metallica, or was it through a publishing company that wanted a Metallica book?
No connection with Metallica at all. Completely unauthorized. And naively, I approached them in the first week and said, can you help? And they were like, no, go away, as they are about most things like that. And I respect that completely now. But no, this was a publisher who had a range of books of a certain style. And I would describe these books as being a sort of general kind of biography for fans who, a broad range of fans. So you'd have people who maybe not mega fans, and maybe people who are new to the band. So you had to pitch your writing and your style to appeal to all kinds of people who might be into Metallica. And I enjoyed doing that. I really enjoyed it, because I had to kind of reel in some of my more sort of mega fan type tendencies and present something that everybody would like. And I think I achieved that, but it was nothing to do with them. And most of the people surrounding the band were reluctant to talk, albeit a few people did. But no, it was just an independent, and it turned out really well.
You know, something like that, where you talk about how you have to reel in your mega fandom. You know, those are the times where, even with this show, where I'm attempting to talk about Pantera, and you know, I'm such a fan that you forget that people don't know a lot of things about Pantera. So when you're writing a book about Metallica, it seems like it might be hard to not put in certain things, because you're like, oh, that's just common knowledge. And then you think about it and you're like, no, I'm just a mega fan.
Yeah. And also, you've got to be objective, because the moment, and I strayed down this path because they asked me to. They wanted to go through albums and kind of break the albums down. It's impossible to not let your opinion to some degree leak into the process when you're doing that. And I look back on that and think that was quite naive at the time. But it just is what it is. But, you know, you learn these things with every book that I've written. You learn something new. And ironically, that's almost the only, bar one other book that I've written for myself in my own name. Everything I've done since has been me writing for someone else, whether it be Rex or Kiki Downing or Brian Slagle at Metal Blade. These are all me writing in their voice, as opposed to me writing a book in my name. So it was a first venture, and I never really did it again. I've done it recently on a completely different thing, but in general, these I've been co-writing ever since.
And did you hear from the Metallica camp after that book was out?
I did. Heard some quite good stuff, and I was always curious whether they were aware of it. And you wonder, and it's your ego that's doing that. You think, oh, I really hope that James is sitting somewhere reading a book about him. And I know Stefan Shirazi, who is a journalist who also manages, I think he manages Metallica's fan club or their fanzine, maybe both. I knew him from the UK. He used to write for Kerrang! Magazine back in the day. And he was in touch with me once, and he told me, he said, oh, I've got a story for you. I was at HQ, and I can't remember what year it would be. I think it would be 2011 or 2012. And he said, oh yeah, Kirk and a couple of guys were sitting in the rehearsal room sort of leafing through your book. And Kirk said, oh, I wonder where he got this photograph, because I dug up some photographs from one of the guys that helped me of, I think it was Kirk's bachelor party or something like that.
Nice.
I'm not even sure Kirk had seen these pictures, but he was amazed to have seen them. And I was just very grateful and very happy that they were aware of the book. I've spoken to James since, and Kirk several times. And I spoke to James for Brian Slagle's Metal Blade book, because I was just interviewing him just as another person to interview for it. And I never mentioned it, and he never mentioned it. But I'm sure we both knew that this was the guy who wrote this book about him all those years ago. I would never say it, and I'm sure he never would either, but I guess he would have known.
And just before we move on, I mean, how is it for you to, you know, think about writing all this time, finally get a book out, and then have it in your hand, you know, written by Mark Eglinton on the cover? You know, how cool is that for you?
Well, it's the coolest thing, much more so at the time, the first time, rather, because, you know, as I said, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know how the process works. And, you know, back in those days, I actually met a deadline. I don't think I've done it since. you think that, you know, the world will end if you do not deliver on the contracted date. And I don't mean this in any way against any of the people that I'll write books for in the future. Don't worry, I will deliver them. But back at that time, I was so keen to make sure everything happened on time. I just didn't know the process. But yeah, when you get the box through the mail with your half a dozen author copies with your name on them, yes, it's fantastic. And it makes it all worthwhile. And does that get less every time? Maybe just a little bit, but it's still good because, you know, there's so much time involved in these things, a year of your life, maybe more, and to actually see it as a product really feels good.
And so that kind of leads us into the official truth 101 proof, the inside story of Pantera. You say you interviewed Rex for that James Hetfield book, and then you said, hey, why don't you do something? How long after that interview did he reach out and go, you know what, maybe we should do that?
That's a good question. I think it was, I would say 3 or 4 months. And we did keep in touch because I think I had a couple of follow-up questions or something. You know, but at that point, you've got contact details. So you've got you can text each other and you can email. That way, you've got some sort of connection. And I think I probably used it more than I might have. I think I always had it in my mind it would be good to do something down the line. So I kept in touch with him. But I do remember that the actual call came from him, and it was in the middle of the night, my time in the UK. Rex used to do that kind of thing. Call me at like 3:30 in the morning. And he did call me at 3:30 in the morning and said, hey, man, I think you know, what we're talking about with the book, I think let's do it type thing. And that was it. He just agreed, let's do this. And from there, we just got going. And I think that would have been sometime in 2011, maybe 2000, yeah, maybe late 2011. The book didn't come out until 2013. So I think it would be 2011.
So what's the process of that? Were you a big fan of Pantera going into this and wanting to know the story, or was it just kind of an opportunity where you threw it out to Rex to say, hey, let's write a book?
Both. I was a huge Pantera fan, had seen them several times, and also from a commercial point of view, as I mentioned earlier, I did see the opportunity. And, you know, as much as you're in this for the creative and the sort of art of writing books, you're also trying to make a living. And I certainly was at that point. And I did have one eye on the commercial appeal of this and thought, well, you know, we should attract a good advance from a publisher. And beyond that, we should sell some copies. And I was right on both counts, but I went into it with both of those things in mind. But I did go into it as a fan. I couldn't say I wasn't. I was a huge fan. But I didn't really, as a fan, didn't really have any opinions. I didn't have any biases either. And that's something I've learned over the years since, that you can't really afford to go into any of these things with any kind of bias. You have to be completely neutral. And you can't let your feelings sway the writing by either going against the person you're working with or going too strongly with them, if that makes sense.
And was this the first co-write you did?
It was, yeah.
So yeah. Did you lean on Joel? Did you call a few people that you knew? Like, how do you go about this, and what's the process? Or did you just kind of wing it?
No, I winged it. And I've always found it easier. And I don't know why that is, actually. I've always been good at talking to people and listening to people. And this goes back to where the sort of transition was for me, because I was caddying. I live in St. Andrews, the home of golf. I'd taken some time out to caddy, and I'll cut this story reasonably short, but was caddying for people, spending 6 hours in the golf course with people, talking to people about their lives, always felt that I created pretty good relationships with the people I worked with, and they always opened up, and I think they felt comfortable with me. And, you know, I left having some great friendships and that kind of thing. And I think I didn't realize it at the time, and I do now. The similarities between that kind of work and what I do now are so huge. It's all about the personal relationship. You know, I can write. That's always been the case. But if you can create the personal relationship and get the trust there from an early stage, you're halfway to being able to co-write with somebody. And, you know, the process of actually creating the text is a bit more difficult, particularly when you're in different continents. But we worked that out, as I'll explain to you later. But yeah, didn't ask advice, just thought, I can do this, and this is how I'm going to do it. And forward we went.
Actually, I have the St. Andrews caddy written down in the notes because, you know, as a fan of sports and as a fan of golf, you know, I've definitely watched St. Andrews on television a few times. So very, very cool that you got to caddy there.
Yeah, that's my hometown. I grew up there. I played out in the old course all the time as a youngster. I still play now and again, but I always wanted to caddy because I just love that whole world, and I still do. There's a huge part of me that would still like to be doing it, simply for the part I mentioned, the meeting people from completely different places, being in their life for 6 hours, then leaving. Co-writing's a bit like that. You're with someone for a year, you're everything in their life, and they're everything in yours, and then it's over. And in 99% of the cases, you're good friends thereafter, and you talk about stuff that's nothing to do with the book. That's the ideal. And as I say, 99% of the cases, that's the case. It becomes something more than just a co-writer subject relationship. You develop a friendship. It's hard not to.
All right. So starting the process of writing the book and learning everything from Rex, do you do a dive into Rex and learn about him, or do you let his story come to you?
Let his story come to me. At an early stage, we wanted to get together in person. In-person talks are much better than phone, although we did some phone stuff because I had to create a proposal to pitch to publishers. That's normal. And for that, I needed a sample chapter. And I think we developed a sample chapter just based on phone conversations that we had. And I picked I can't even remember what the sample chapter was, to be honest. But I picked a part of the Pantera trajectory and said, listen, talk to me for a couple of hours about this. And just let him completely kind of freestyle on it. I would try and steer him. I've got better at that over the years as well. That's something you learn, to try and keep people on track. But Rex just went all over the place, and I recorded it. Then I went back with a recording, and I started building text in his voice. And I'll come on to voice later, because it's quite an important part of this book, and it's intentional. But yeah, that's how we did it. We started on that basis. Then we decided that one way or the other, we had to get together in person to get the really to get the meat of the book done, and also to get some of the tougher parts of the book done from a sort of emotional standpoint for him. I think he felt more comfortable doing it face to face.
Yeah, I do enjoy that the book kind of starts and ends with kind of his relationship about, you know, Dime and things like that. You know, it's an early thing in the book. It's also late in the book. And obviously, it's a huge part of the Pantera story. How was he, you know, kind of coming? You know, was it hard to get those emotions out of him, or was he easy to talk to and kind of, you know, letting him go?
No, Rex was easy, and that what you mentioned there, the prologue of dropping. I mean, it was an intentional thing, and it was an idea of mine actually, which I had to run past him. Why don't we drop the readers right into the middle of the story, right at the beginning? Because, you know, if you pick up a book and it's a sort of slow build up, you know, from, you know, I was born on X day, blah, you know, yeah. I've seen lots of books like that. It's good. It works. But if you drop someone right into the core of the story, I think you've got them hooked for the duration. And I wanted to do that. And it made sense to make it one of the most compelling parts of the story. So I went straight for that. And he was, I think he found it difficult to talk about it. I don't think Rex would deny if I was to say that I don't think speaking about his emotions is something that comes particularly naturally to him. That's not a criticism at all. That's common to a lot of us. But I think he's in that category. I think he sometimes struggles with that. But again, we built a bit of trust, and, you know, I think he felt comfortable with me, and I could encourage him with the right kind of prompts. And we got there quite easily. And that was the case throughout, I have to say.
And when it comes to a lot of the stories in the book about, you know, the things that he, I guess, wanted to talk about when it comes to Pantera, it kind of threw me off a little bit that, you know, some of my recollections of Pantera, I was 14 when Far Beyond Driven came out, changed my whole life and all that stuff. And I saw them, you know, multiple times throughout the years. And, you know, where I would want him to maybe go into a little bit more about touring with White Zombie. You know, it was just like, yeah, and then we toured with White Zombie, and then I bought a house, and, you know, it was in a really nice neighborhood, and I'm like, well, why are we talking about this? Let's get back to the touring stories and stuff like that. It was kind of strange, some of the stories that he did give out, like the skiing story. I thought was a little odd, and obviously very anti Vinny in that story. You know, it's a lot of stuff in there, man. That's just kind of strange that's what he wanted to talk about rather than, you know, and then we, you know, sold out this show or something like that. I don't know. Kind of threw me off a little.
I'll give you an observation on that. And this is something I found from quite a lot of people. And it's not with everybody. A lot of these guys don't remember it. And B, these guys don't care.
True.
You know, the drama and the sort of romance in a band, I don't think necessarily the artists always see like fans. You know, we see that. We think about, oh, they toured with White Zombie and that was awesome, or they played this show and it was a sellout. You know, when you've done however many dates it is, I just think you get past caring.
Yeah.
You just don't see what's such a big deal about it. And in lots of cases, Rex just didn't remember. It just all blurred. And beyond that, when you talk about the other stories, I think there was a big desire from him, and I wasn't discouraging of it, to present a sort of more rounded life picture of him rather than it just being all about Pantera. He wanted to show a different side to his life, good or bad, and give a sort of impression of what, you know, the sort of wider world around him and Pantera was. And his way of doing it was trying to have a sort of parallel story running of what his home life was. And he talks about that on and off switch, which I thought was a great analogy at the time, still do, how he had to sort of disengage from being in Pantera and go to being dad and doing stuff like choosing Tyler's Kitchen or something like that. I think that's reality.
Yeah.
I think the stuff on the road touring is just a job. So the aim at the time, if I remember correctly, was just to try and present something a bit broader.
Do you think had this book been written maybe after Vinny's passing that he might have maybe not went so hard at Vinny? I feel like he went very hard at Vinny. Maybe he held a little bit of a grudge towards Vinny with how Vinny treated him at the funeral. And, you know, and even before the funeral, just kind of the way that Vinny treated him. Because, I mean, it kind of seems like he went into the book with a very negative view of Vinnie Paul.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the main points I want to make about this kind of thing. And it applies in almost every case. You know, when someone writes a book or creates music or something, it is done at that a certain moment in their life. And into that process, whether it's writing a book, whether it's making music, you have to absorb everything else that's going on in your world at that time. It is literally a time capsule of, and in this case, it was 2011, 2012. And I know for a fact that Rex was going through a lot of tough stuff at that time. He had real issues with his pancreas. He was having health issues. He was having other personal issues. But there was a lot going on. And when you combine that with the tension that had been existing there in Pantera and post Pantera, I think, you know, when you asked me, would it have been a different book after Vinny passed? It might have been a different book 5 minutes after we wrote it, or five minutes before. Do you know what I'm getting?
Yeah,
at?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's literally just, it's what it was at that moment. And Rex and I have talked about it. It was, you know, he and I are both completely different people than we were when we did it back then. And as I also said, I'm sure there was a part of me, I was going through quite a difficult time in my life when we were doing it. So throw all that energy into it, and I think you come out with what you come out with. It was what it was at that moment. But would it have been different afterwards? I'm sure it would have been.
And I know you said you started the book, you know, doing some phone stuff, but then you did get to be in person and do some touring with Rex. Elaborate a little bit on that and that experience.
The first meeting was actually my 40th birthday, and Rex invited me to come out to Bucharest, Romania with the band to play. They were supporting AC/DC, and he said, you know, come out to Romania, you'll meet us, you can stay there. I took my brother with me, and we flew out there, and we met in the hotel bar, and my brother and I were sitting there having a drink, and the down guys came in later. And I remember from that moment, this is something that existed thereafter, I remember there being a great deal of tension around at that time, and less so from Phil, who I got on with and still get along great with, would say less from him, but from the other guys in Down, I thought there was a great deal of suspicion about, you know, what is this? What is this guy going to want to know? And just a general sort of reticence to the whole process. So we spent the weekend there, had a meal with Rex at night, watched them play with AC/DC. I think Ronnie James Dio passed away one of the nights we were there, which was weird. And then we didn't do any work on that trip. And then we tried to fly back to the UK and then to the States. And I think it was around that time that the volcano in Iceland was shutting down the entire Europe flight system because there was smoke everywhere. And I think my brother and I got out, but I think Rex might have been stuck there for another day. Anyway, whatever happened, that was our first meeting. Then again, I was scheduled to see them in the summer at a festival in London. I think it was High Voltage Festival where they played. Then the morning after that, we were all flying out to Spain to go on the road with them to a festival that ultimately ended up in a place called Ribeiro, which is in northern Spain, where they were headlining. And I think we were due to stay in Spain for 5 or 6 nights. And when we got to Spain, and this is where it got weird. Are you quite happy with me just rolling with this? Because this is
yeah,
just
keep going, man.
Going.
This is great.
We got to Spain and got to this hotel, and it was a big hotel, and we're all going to be in this place, and we looked around at our rooms, and all of a sudden Rex took me aside and said, you and I aren't staying here. I was like, okay, what are we doing? He said, we're going to find somewhere of our own because, you know, all these guys around, it's going to be a mess. And I thought that was strange. And I just went with it. I was like, okay, so we hire a car. He gets in touch with some guy who I don't know how he knew and rents this cottage or sort of cabin in the middle of the woods down some driveway, you know, literally 5 miles from the nearest town. So we're driving down this track in a rental van to this house, just me and Rex Brown, into this place. And I didn't know what he'd said to the band. I had no idea what the dynamic was. But we got there, and this was where we did the sort of bulk of the writing. But things got stranger because it was pretty obvious that there was a lot of tension in the band. Rex was still drinking and didn't want the other band members to know. I found out that the reason we were staying there was that he could do. So that put me in a really tricky position because I almost felt like I was being looked at as somebody who was enabling him. And it was really nothing to do with me whatsoever. I was just being told, you know, come on, we're going to stay in a cabin. Let's go and stay in a cabin. And we did. But that's where the writing took place. He and I spent all our time in there, occasionally venturing out in this rental van into the local town. And we didn't really see the band members until the end of the sort of trip when they were due to play the show at the festival. And things kind of took a dark turn that night as well.
Being around the Down guys, and obviously, you know, with Anselmo coming out after and saying that, you know, there was a great deal of mythology about how Rex quit the band. You know, do you feel that he quit the band? Do you feel like he was kicked out of the band? You know, where what's your take on all that?
He was kicked out of the band, and that show in Spain was the last show he played.
Oh no!
It was also the last show Kurt played for a while. as I remember, it was just chaos.
Yeah.
But prior to that, you know, we were in this place. These guys would turn up. I think it was his birthday one night. It was, because it was July. And they turned up out of the blue one night. And I seem to remember Pepper Keenan getting sort of aggressive with me and sort of thrusting me up against the wall or something and saying, you know, you're doing this to Rex and doing that to Rex. And I remember thinking, sorry, you got it all wrong here. It's nothing to do with me. And by the way, you know, don't be shoving me up against walls. We did not get along at all. And I remember one of the down roadies, doesn't matter who it is, he coming up to me that night and saying, this book, you'll never get this book done, son. And I remember thinking at that point, okay, fine, but we will get this book done. And that just made me think, we will get this finished. But there was a few moments on that trip to Spain where I was ready to bail. I remember phoning my agent. I remember driving up the track one night. I think it was that night after these guys left. I drove up a track to get a signal on my phone and called my agent and said, you might need to get me out of here because I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah.
He said, listen, this tension is great. You know, you're right in the sort of eye of the hurricane here. It's going to create great prose. And at that time, I didn't want to hear that. I just wanted to leave. But looking back now, he's absolutely right. The tension did create the kind of book that we got. The book is jagged. It's intense. It's a little bit sort of it's a little bit disjointed. But that's just how we were. That's how the life was at the moment. And it came out exactly as the process went.
It kind of sounds like, you know, you're a terrible analogy, but like almost famous, you know, when the reporter is on the road with them and, you know, that whole, like, you know, the guy at home saying, you know, you can't be friends with them. And you know, they kind of view the kid as the enemy and all that stuff. And, you know, you're out there to write a book and there's no telling what those guys are doing. And they're like having to watch what they're doing because they don't want it to end up in a book. And, you know, it seems like a very sketchy situation.
It is a difficult situation, and with the best will in the world, you try and please everyone. I didn't go out of my way to sort of ingratiate myself with anyone, nor did I go out of my way to be unpleasant to anyone. You know, I tried to play absolutely straight with all of them. I always got on okay with Jimmy. No problems with Jimmy. I had no problems with Kurt, but Kurt was on the way out of down at that point. And I got on fine with Phil, by and large. Pepper, I didn't, and a couple of the other guys in the crew, I didn't. But, you know, at the end of the day, you get through the process, and we got to the last night, and they were playing, and it wasn't pretty. I remember filming it from the side of the stage, and I think Kurt played the wrong song at one point, and they were looking around, and it was just a mess. And I think, I can't remember whether Kurt said he was quitting or whether they said he was leaving that night. But he did. And I remember the next morning on the bus, we were going somewhere and it was just this horrible atmosphere where it felt the heaviest atmosphere and not in a good way. And there was nothing directly said about Rex at the time, but I think I'm right in saying that was the last time Rex ever played in Down.
Was there any moment where Phil said anything to you like, hey man, just don't make me look like a dick, or, you know, any kind of those moments?
Not at all, ever. Never has he said that. As I said, I'm still in touch with Phil.
Yeah.
Bizarrely, we communicate quite a lot, but never about music. I'm a big boxing fan, and so is he. And we trade emails about, like, obscure Kazakhstan heavyweight contenders. And at no point do we ever discuss Rex's book, Pantera, music at all. And I think that's just an understanding that there's no point. There was the, you know, I never had anything from him to say, don't make me look this way or that way. He never mentioned it.
Yeah, I've had,
which
I've had Phil on my other podcast, and I ask him about the New Orleans Saints as, you know, his favorite football team, and that's when he perks up. You know, it's talking about music all day is one thing, but you get him going about sports or football and he's ready to go.
100%, and I respect that hugely. I respect him hugely. So he's one of my favorite people, and I never had any problem with them when I was working with Rhett.
So after all of the, you know, you do the interviews with Terry Glaze and Rex's sister and Rita and Kate and, you know, everybody that you have in the book.
Walter.
Yeah. Once you get all that together, how long did it take for you to compile the book? And then Rex, I think, said something about there were at least 10 edits. So, you know, once you get to that process, how long did it take?
10 edits. Deary me. It didn't kind of work like that because I was kind of writing you know how the book goes, there's the sort of the main guiding narrative, and then you cut to these talking heads of people talking, whether it be Rita or whoever it was. I was just kind of moving the main narrative forward the whole time, and I was leaving, and in my mind I was making mental notes. If and when I speak to X or Y, we'll have some content from them there. If I don't, we'll just carry on. And so on and so forth. So I was grabbing these people as I went. Some of them very late in the day. I think Walter O'Brien I spoke to a few days before the book was finished.
Oh, wow.
Similarly, Kate, Phil's partner, I think I spoke to her maybe the day before we delivered. And it was just a case of dropping in material right at the end. But in total, to actually the whole text... 6-7 months. That was to create a first draft. And then Rex and I went back and forward, which would be normal. You know, I submit a draft. He has a look at it, comes back with ideas, you know, maybe change this, maybe change that. And, you know, you go from there and you kind of hone it down with successive sort of passes at this. Then it goes to the editor at the publisher and he does the same. And, you know, eventually you get to the point where you've got something that you think is pretty much a finished book.
But you're saying that everything in the book Rex signed off on.
100%. I mean, are you referring to the blabbermouth thing that came out a long time after the book came out?
Yeah, the quote was, "There was a bunch of shit in my book that was not supposed to be in that book. And I went through 10 different edits. And they put it in there anyway, and it left a fucking bit of sour in some people's mouths."
Yeah, that's not true. And I said so at the time. And the agenda for that was that I think Rex was talking to Phil and perhaps Vinny at the time about the possibility of getting back together to do something. And I think he needed to distance himself from what was in the book. Simple as that. And I think that he was quite happy to throw me and the publisher under the bus by saying that. And I, you know, I'm loyal to everyone I work with, but when I'm put in that position, I have to stand up for myself. And I also have to stand up for the publisher because at the end of the day, I'll work with other people and I have done. And I would never want anyone to think that I would put something in a book that they didn't sign off on. I would never do that. I make it very clear that anything that goes in there, they must sign off on. And I knew it was signed off. So I'm afraid that that was just wishful thinking and an attempt to sort of distance himself, maybe in retrospect from some of the things he said. But everything that was in that book was signed off.
Yeah, it's one of those things where reading it, you know, over the last week or so, just some of the stuff, I was laying in bed reading it one night, my wife, and I just started laughing. I was like, can you believe Rex is the whole skiing story is just still like... blows me away when he's like, and then that fat fuck, you know, and I was just like, wow, man, that's like, how do you talk about somebody like that in a book? I don't know. I could never do it.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, these things people do, and it goes back to the frame of mind and what was going on in the life at the time. You know, as I said, you know, lots of different forces, lots of different things going on in life. I'm sure further down the line, you look at it and you think, well, I really wish that is not what I wrote.
Right.
I really wish that wasn't in there. Unfortunately, you can't. All you can do is feel differently. And you can say so. You can say, you know what? I did write that in the book at the time because that's how I felt. But I would much rather somebody did that than turned around and said, you know, it shouldn't have been in there. Because that suggests that something underhand was done.
Right.
By either me or anyone else involved in the production. And that is not the case. 100% is not the case. He may feel differently, and I'm sure he does. And that's great. I applaud that. But let's keep it straight.
Did you have any conversations with him after those comments were made? Like, dude, come on, seriously.
Yeah, it wasn't we fell out for a long time. It wasn't nice at all. And, you know, he said some things to me that were very unpleasant. He made out that I was making it about me, which I wasn't at all. I mean, God, it was the opposite of that. I was saying, this is just not what happened. And we did not speak for a long time, and it wasn't very nice. And I can't even remember how we did speak again, but eventually we did. And, you know, I just let it go, and I'm sure he just let it go as well. And as I said, it was 10 years ago now, or 11, 8 years ago, 9 years ago. It's a long time. Lots happens in life.
Right.
You just got to move on from it. But that's what I've done anyway.
How far into your next project were you when those comments were coming out? Were you starting to talk with what was the next project after that? Was it the Metal Blade book, or was it the what was it?
Actually, the next one was nothing to do with metal. I mean, I've written books about heavy metal. I've also written books with sports people.
Right.
And the next one was a sports co-write. So it was a completely different landscape. In every sense, UK based, very, very civil, I don't want to say gentle. It wasn't gentle, but it just didn't have the edginess of that. And I was very happy that it didn't. So there was no overlap. There was no sort of, at no point did I ever think, you know, would somebody who might be working with me have seen this and be concerned? That didn't even enter my mind. That was part of the reason why I did it, so that if somebody did have any doubts, they would see that I was just taking a stand. But I think I was pretty much into the next, or even a good halfway through my next project by the time those comments came out. And it didn't affect it. It's never affected anything since.
And I guess the final thing on the Pantera book itself, I mean, what was the major kind of revelation for you with the band Pantera that kind of came across to you that you may not have known going into it?
I didn't realize really how separate Phil was towards the end. I mean, he was riding in different buses from not even the end, from quite a bit before the end. And something I've learned often from people in the aftermath who I've spoken to about Pantera, lots of people met Vinny and Dime, lots of people met Rex. A lot of people said, yeah, I never really saw Phil. And I think that's right. And I didn't appreciate it. Phil was his own dressing room, a little bit distant, different buses, as I said. I didn't really appreciate that. I always thought they were pretty united and kind of in it together. That's not the case. And in fact, it's not the case in most bands.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of bands project that. And in, I would say, more than 50% of the cases, that's not the case. Because personal stuff gets in the way. When you're with someone every day, you just get tired of them, and you'll find, you know, sure, you'll appear on stage and you know you'll do what you're there to do, but I think in the interim you want your own space. I didn't really appreciate that dynamic in there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, when I met them when I was in 1994, I met all four of them, but Phil was very much the last one, and he was very quick. And then I saw Pantera, like pretty much every time I saw Pantera, we somehow managed a backstage pass or something. But yeah, it was, yeah. But then I didn't, from that first time I saw Phil in 94, I don't think I actually met him again until maybe just a couple of years ago. So yeah, I guess you're right on that one.
Yeah, he withdrew. Tell me this, as a Pantera fan, what did it make you feel about the band reading Rex's book? I mean, if you want to take out the the sort of personal aspect of Rex's opinion on Vinny, because I thought Rex was actually reasonably fair on Dime. Some people said that he gave Dime a bit of a bashing. I disagree on that. I thought he was very balanced about Dime. And he also gave Vinny some credit as well. Granted, he gave him a bit of a bashing on some other things. But as a fan, how did it make you feel about Pantera?
You know, a lot of it, it wasn't too far off of what I thought. I mean, I did find it very odd, kind of his wording towards Vinny. You know, you always see the you grew up on the home videos and all that stuff. And you feel like they are a band of just four fun loving dudes, But then, you know, I've been in bands and I've been around bands my whole life. And, you know, no matter how fun loving they look to the outside, I mean, you know, it's four dudes that, you know, maybe one doesn't like the other kind of thing. Yeah. I think the one thing that I didn't know a whole lot about was towards the end, when how you talk about how distant Phil was. I'm talking like, you know, Reinventing the Steel era, how mm-hmm. distant they were. And then even in the book, they kind of talk about, you know, Dime and Rex kind of talking right before the shooting in 2004. I didn't realize how maybe close it was to them, you know, just saying the Damage Plan was a side project and, you know, we'll get Pantera back eventually. So yeah, I didn't realize they were talking that much towards the end.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And equally for me, that was a revelation, because in the press, if you'd gone on what was going on in the press, you would have thought there was no way.
Right.
It's impossible. But yeah, I agree. And Rex has said often, we would have got back together. And I'm convinced they would have. It might have taken a couple of years, but I think they would have. And that's the biggest shame of it all.
Yeah. And the, you know, but it was fun to kind of see that perspective from Rex, because Rex obviously wasn't the most outgoing one. You know, when you think about Pantera, you think of Dime and you think of him, you know, just kind of being outgoing and outlandish and filming everything. And I said 1,000 times on my other show, man, Dimebag was made for social media. Like, he would have been the king of like Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat. It would have been so fun.
Yeah, I totally agree.
But, you know, and then after that, you know, you go on to do other metal books. You talked about the sports books too, man, but you did the Metal Blade book. You did the KK Downing book. It's funny. Every time I talked to, I brought up that I was going to talk to you, everybody brought up the KK book. So I guess that went over very well.
And well, there's another example. You know, everyone thought that KK and Glenn Tipton were best friends. Couldn't be further from the truth. They never got along. And I guess it's a similar type of story, you know, in all these bands. It's personal dynamics. And, you know, just like you and I, you know, or somebody working in an office or wherever they work, you know, you can do the job, but are you going to necessarily want to be with that person the whole time, particularly when you're kind of forced into the microcosm of a tour bus or whatever it is? It's really tough. And I think if you can survive as long as some bands have without a major breakdown, I think you're doing well.
And as we kind of wrap this up, man, what are you working on now? You have anything else in the works?
Yeah, I do. I've got a couple of things going. I can't discuss them, actually, because one is metal related. I've got a couple of other books that are not metal, not sports related, just nonfiction approaches that I've had from people who have liked the way that I've told stories and want me to write their story. And I can't discuss what they're about because they're kind of news related. And, you know, anyone that's interested in what I'm doing can see what I'm doing on Twitter, because I will post anything that I can out there. But the metal side of things is something that I've kind of gone through in my head a lot about what I would do. And to be honest, there are not a lot of sort of great metal stories out there that I'd be that enthused about doing. I can't off the top of my head think of someone that if they came to me and said, listen, would you co-write my book, that I would absolutely drop everything for. There isn't anyone in metal that fits into that category. And that makes it more difficult. There's books related to metal, and I'm doing one related to metal, which I love. But a co-write within metal, I just don't know there's any big stories out there anymore. That's just the way I feel.
Well, I will say that the Rex book, you know, you talked about it being in his voice earlier. You know, I definitely walked away from that book thinking that I was, you know, reading his words and hearing his voice in my head. So I think you did a very good job with that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's very difficult, because as much as you want to make someone sound like Shakespeare or whatever, if someone picks it up and Rex sounds like Shakespeare, they're going to say that's not authentic. Whereas if they pick it up and they maybe hear some of his idioms or the kind of figures of speech that he uses, and we know what they are, and if they see them there, they'll feel that authenticity. And it's a very difficult line to tread, because you don't want to make someone sound like an idiot, and you also don't want to make them sound like they don't sound. So that's probably the biggest challenge of co-writing. You've got to get that voice. whatever it is, you've got to pin that down very early and stick with it.
And as we wrap it up, man, what's the best way for people to follow you and to go check out your books?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do much social media, only Twitter. I'm on there. On Amazon, if you go there and, you know, look up one of my books there, you will find an author page. And alongside that, you'll see any titles that I've done listed there. And that's the best way. But I'm on Twitter and I post about the books that I do. And I post about a few other things as well. So anyone interested in what I'm doing, they can just find me there and I'll give you a follow back and we can sort of go along together and see what's happening.
And then the last question I'm asking you, everybody, is what's your favorite Pantera song?
Yeah, I'll go with Goddamn Electric.
Nice.
Reinventing the Steel is my favorite Pantera album.
Have you heard the remixes?
Yeah.
Listen, I think they sound awesome. Like I'm.
Yeah, they do. I think it's a great album. I really do. So yeah, that would be my choice.
Well, Mark Eglinton, man, thank you so much for taking the time, and make sure everybody to go out there and check out Official Truth 101 Proof, the inside story of Pantera. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks very much. You take care, okay?
Okay. All right, huge thank you to Mark Eglinton. Make sure you are supporting all of his books. Go check out everything he has done. Let your friends know that you are checking out the Drag the Waters podcast. That will be much appreciated. So until next time, for Drag the Waters, I've been Joshua Toomey, and I will talk to you guys soon.